Well, happy Monday. Welcome to Main Street. It's back to the grind. I'm Eric Dethridge. Hope you had a wonderful Christmas. If you partake, happy Kwanzaa, the week-long celebration of African-American heritage. That's in full swing right now. In fact, there was a big celebration in Grand Forks yesterday at the Empire Arts Center. Speaking of Grand Forks, later in the show, Tom Brousseau will take you to a downtown eatery called Ellie's Ivy. They pride themselves on sourcing local produce and meats. And right now, it's not exactly farm to table, but from a local author's pen to your eyes, so we'll call it locally sourced. Craig Blumenschein talks with the author of a North Dakota set romance novel.
For many writers, inspiration begins at home, and that's certainly true for Lillian Jobert. She's a North Dakota author who writes both swoon-worthy romance and epic fantasy stories right here on the prairie. She publishes her romance novels, and she's known for sweet, uplifting love stories rooted in hope and humor, including her holiday rom-com, Freelance Fiancé at Mistletoe Inn, set in a fictional small town of Story Brant, North Dakota. But romance isn't her only lane. She also writes fantasy, or what she calls romanticy, inspired by the same imagination that once had her checking wardrobes for a doorway to Narnia. Yes, Lillian, welcome to Main Street.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
If I understand it right, from Minnesota, you now live in rural North Dakota with your husband and a small zoo of rescue pets. Is that kind of right?
Yes, that's right.
What brought you into writing? And then I'm going to ask you, what makes a good romantic book?
Oh, man. Oh, those are good questions. So first of all, what brought me into writing? Ever since I was little, I've loved story. And it's just been something that's been super powerful in my life. And like Narnia and Chronicles of Narnia, I've always enjoyed reading C.S. Lewis's books. But also another big influence in my life was my grandma. And she grew up on the prairies of North Dakota in a little shack and near like Lake Sakakawea and everything. And so she would tell us stories about growing up on the prairies. And she'd set all the kids around and be like, okay, back in the olden days, this is what happened. She'd tell us like stories and about teaching a one-room schoolhouse. And it was just so amazing. So just kind of like hearing those stories from the olden days really kind of spoke to me. And I was like, oh my gosh, I want to tell stories. And then I read C.S. Lewis's Chronicles of Narnia for the first time. And I'm like, these stories are powerful. And I want to make a difference in people's lives too.
When did you learn that you could actually write? Because I enjoy reading and I read a lot. But I don't consider myself a good writer. When did you know that, I can do this?
Oh, man. I remember, and this is before we had computer, like laptops to carry around. So I had notebooks full of like my little stories, and I've been like writing my stories and carrying them around with me. But yeah, I don't know. I kind of like with that creative mind just kind of ended up creating stories. I didn't, before I even really knew what I was doing. But when I really noticed it in like high school, I was like, oh man, that is kind of cool. And that was really well done. So I think I could do this.
So you describe your romance novels as being anchored in hope and humor. What draws you to writing uplifting, clean romantic comedies?
Right. Oh my goodness. That's a good question. I mean, there's so many different types of romance books out there and everything. And I feel like I want mom and dads to feel comfortable where if the book is in the house and their teenager picks it up, they aren't going to feel like they have to be worried about anything in it. So that's kind of what I want. I want to feel like, you know, moms, teenagers, college students can read it and, you know, enjoy the story and not worry about any questionable things about, you know, in it and everything. It's kind of a whole thing in the romance world. You've got the people who write the dirty scenes. You've got the people who write the sweet stuff, and both are kind of like, oh my gosh, I can't do that. And it just, yeah, the sweet authors are like, oh, I can't write that. And then the other ones are like, oh gosh, I can't write that. So
who do you write for? Do you write for teens? Do you write for young moms? Do you write for senior moms? Who do you write for?
Well, yeah, that's a great question too. And I right now am kind of like writing for like the new adult sort of who in college, like, you know, 21 to 28. kind of writing for them. But of course, if a mom or senior mom or, you know, a teenager picks it up, they're not going to be like, they'll be able to enjoy a good story. Let's put it that
way. So I have this little thing I do with my wife when she watches rom-coms on TV, movies or whatever, especially this time of year. There are a lot of them that are on. And in 2 seconds, yeah, I say, he's going to marry her. Why watch the rest of the story? Is it hard for you to come up with storylines that are unique and catching?
Oh, yeah. Sometimes, like, I mean, like you mentioned, all the Christmas movies that are out right now, like you can kind of spot the plot before it comes and everything. And it's like, oh, I knew that was going to happen. I really get excited when I watch something and I'm like, okay, I didn't see that coming. But yeah, when it comes to writing, I'm kind of a pantser plotter, a little in between both of them. So I feel like sometimes the plot side can be a little bit harder, where it's like, okay, how can we figure this out so that's unique and different? But my husband is really good at plot and I'm really good at character. So we kind of help each other out with that. So it's been wonderful kind of coming up with these stories and thinking, okay, so what could make this more unique. So I've really enjoyed that.
So you tag team writing with your husband kind of a little bit?
Yeah, sometimes. So he also writes and everything. I end up brainstorming, kind of telling him, I've got this idea. What do you think about this? And he's like, okay, yeah, I like this. Or what if you did this? And so, yeah, we kind of talk about like story and brainstorming together. So
I've got your newest book, Freelance Fiancé at Mistletoe Inn, in my hand. It's got a really cool cover. How do you come up with the art for your covers?
Okay, well, that's a great question. I actually, like, going way back before I could write, I loved drawing. So I actually illustrated that cover.
Wow, yeah.
Yeah. So I illustrated those covers. There's a few covers of, like, our anthologies that we have out that my husband illustrated. He works at an architecture firm in Fargo, so he's really creative with drawing and stuff. The covers, oh my gosh, that's one thing that really draws me in when you find a new book. So I wanted to make sure our books were the same, where they capture you with the
unique
cover.
Thing about this cover is there is a man and there's a woman, right? We got a rom-com and a beautiful little inn maybe, yep, in the background, but they're faceless. Why?
Yes. So it's kind of like it's kind of a weird rom-com trope for covers these days. Like if you end up searching rom-com books on Google, you'll end up seeing a lot of them without facial expressions and stuff, which is
give
kind
me
of
the
funny.
Elevator pitch for the book. It's your newest one. It's kind of set in this fictional North Dakota place. Tell me about it.
Yeah. Okay. Most definitely. So Addison, she's coming back from New York City to North Dakota to inherit her great aunt's inn, and she has to do it before Christmas. But the thing is, she's actually single, and in order to inherit the place, she has to be engaged. So that's her little conundrum at the beginning of the book. So she's kind of in a pickle.
And it reads well through. North Dakota isn't the first place, at least in my mind, when I think of romance novels, right? But you've really embraced it.
Right.
How does living here and your experience with small town life influence, Lillian, the stories that you tell?
Oh, that's a wonderful question. I love it. I think that as a writer, we're told from, like, you know, if you went to school for writing or anything, you hear people say, write what you know. And I feel like I have like a really strong connection to North Dakota, going back even like when my grandma was telling me stories about growing up on the prairies in North Dakota. And I just have a love for the state and everything. And I mean, like you said, I grew up in Minnesota, but I've always felt like North Dakota was part of my home too. So I just feel like you don't see North Dakota in books very much, you know, like I've read a lot of rom-coms and a lot of books in general, and I really haven't seen North Dakota in the book. So I was like, well, we're going to set this little fictional town in North Dakota near Fort Ransom, which is beautiful. And we're going to do that. And I know there's been a few readers who have been like, oh my gosh, I love that this is local and I can see the place. I know where this is. And yeah, I just love
walk
that.
Me through your typical riding day at your rural house. You've got a mini zoo of pets. We've talked about that. And I understand you're maybe the household barista too. Is that true? Okay.
Yes.
So what does your writing day actually look like?
Yes. Oh my gosh. It's a good question. So I wake up in the morning and I kind of like start writing for a few hours and everything. And then right before like lunch, I will check emails and kind of do like admin things. And Wednesdays are more so like my social media and marketing and more admin stuff. But otherwise, I try to keep a pretty scheduled schedule, I guess, if you can say, when it comes to writing, so that I'm getting at least 2,000 to 5,000 words a day. So that's what I'm trying for. And sometimes I fall short of that, but sometimes I do write more.
How did you bridge the publishing gap, right? You can be a great writer, but you have to get your work published. And that's always a struggle for many who walk into this arena and they want folks to read their book. And now I need to publish it. And there's so many options. How did it work out for you?
Sure. Okay. So I kind of went into publishing a little bit different because normally people will, you know, write query letters and send them off to publishers and everything. But I was like, okay, well, I'm going to bootstrap this and I'm going to start my own publishing company called Burning Branch Publishing. And we're gonna publish our own books. And that means like our books and other people's books. We are working with a few different authors. We haven't published yet, but we're thinking about it. So, but it's really cool being able to kind of have that freedom where you can, you know, choose your covers, because a lot of like, you know, a lot of authors out there struggle to be able to pick their covers because the publishers work with like a cover designer, and once they buy the rights,
it wasn't what I was thinking.
Out of your hands. It's like, oh my goodness. And so kind of that freedom to be able to do what you want a little bit more with the book. And then I ended up going to this big publishing conference in Vegas. Back then it was called 20 Books. Now it's called Author Nation, but it's the biggest indie author convention in the country. And these people, like, it's crazy. Like, you could be a mid-list author in indie author, an indie author, mid-list author, and be able to quit your day job and work full time from it. Well, if you're published under a publisher, you might have to keep a side job too. But they're both great avenues to take, you know, going through publisher, going through indie. They're just different routes because, of course, with indie, you have a lot of hats to wear.
Enjoying my conversation with Lillian Jobert. She's an author from North Dakota who writes swoon-worthy romance and epic fantasy stories right here on the prairie. She publishes her romance novels, and she's known for sweet, uplifting love stories rooted in hope and humor. You'd said that you had been to a writer's convention, but in my mind, maybe writing like you do is a solitary world. How do you keep involved and connected with what is really a solitary kind of vocation?
Oh, yes, that is a great question, because that is a constant battle for authors, writers in general. And it's because, you know, you're sitting behind a computer screen the whole time and everything. And it's like, man, it's just me and the computer. But that's where it's really great when you know, build like a following on social media, and you can kind of like meet other authors through. That's been my major lifeline. And then through that, I've met a lot of like local authors too, through North Dakota and everything. So it's been wonderful to do that, but definitely having to put yourself out there in social media and look through hashtags, find people that are in your tribe. And then it's not as solitary.
So what's your biggest challenge then?
Oh my goodness. I guess it's just, biggest challenge. I would say, well, marketing can be a big challenge, like sending emails and getting them all, getting it so that you're sending the right amount, so you're not sending too many. Also making sure you send them so people keep remembering you. That, and then also just staying consistent with getting the words out so you can get the next book done.
Where can people find your books?
Yeah. Okay. So you can get them at burningbranchpublishing.com. or at Amazon, and they are available print. I have some as well in hardcover, also on KDP. We are hopefully working with some audiobook narrators in the future to get them on Audible as well. But that's where you can find them right now.
So what's next for you?
Oh my goodness. So what's next? I am currently working on finishing the second book in the Story Brant series. So that's the Freelance Fiancé at Mistletoe Inn. There's a cowboy and a city girl. And so that's always a fun trope. So that's the one I'm currently working on finishing here and
getting
out.
Are there projects out there that you can't wait to get in touch with, but you have to wait because you have to be structured in what you do?
Yeah. Yes. And if I could have my way, I would probably be like Doug in Up, where it's like squirrel, squirrel. I would probably be like that. But yes, trying to be consistent and scheduled where it's like, okay, I need to get this one out. Even though like once you've gotten to a certain point, you're like, okay, I'm ready for the next one. I need to work on the next book, but need to follow through and finish the
author,
first one.
How does feedback work for you as an author? When you hear from people who have read your book, have they influenced you, or do you have something in mind that you just want to go with?
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Feedback is so important as an author. I feel like I have a few different CPs, so critique partners and beta readers, and they're the ones who kind of read the book before anyone else. And then they give you feedback and like, okay, that was really good. Or this spot needs a little work, or they kind of just let you know like, okay, I liked this or I didn't like that, or which they can be very detailed and everything. So that's really, I guess the more detailed,
is that a hard process for you to like, oh, I thought that was so good, and you're telling me that I need to do X or Y?
I guess it's kind of like too, I mean, where, you know, you think that your baby's beautiful and perfect, but
you don't win the Gerber
when
prize.
They step out into the world. They step out into the world, they're like, oh goodness, your baby's doing something wrong, or your baby's not perfect. And it's like, but I thought they were. But yeah, so it's kind of like that with books. I feel like, you know, you put it out there, and then people either love it, or there's something they don't like about it. Or I mean, and sometimes it's just something you can't even control. Everyone has
so
different tastes.
With the authors that I've interviewed lately, I have to ask the question, how does AI influence your world, and what are you worried about with AI?
Oh, that's a good question. Yes, AI is such a huge topic in the writing world today, and well, all areas actually, art and everything. But oh goodness, AI. I mean, I've found myself just using AI like Google, honestly. If I have a question or anything, like, or wondering something, then I look it up through there because I just get the answer so quick compared to Google. Right. Then it saves me time. And I know I have used it for like marketing ideas and such like that, because my brain just is a well that's so dry when it comes to marketing sometimes. But otherwise, I mean, definitely that I have seen other people who have, like, you know, written full books with AI. And I mean, I don't know. Like, for me, I mean, that might work for them, but I just don't feel like that's right for me, you know? And so it's definitely a topic that's very, you know, people feel strongly about it on either side and everything. And yeah, it's a tricky topic, because I think maybe too, it's probably like when, you know, the internet came out, everyone was like, I don't know, do we want to do this? Do we want to do that? I don't know. I guess with every new thing in technology, we're all moving towards these new things that we've never dealt with before. But I definitely think there's good ways to use it and not so good ways to use it.
What's a successful book for you?
Oh, successful. I think it's a book that I can sit down and read, and I get fully immersed without thinking I'm actually reading, and get pulled into the characters and the world. And I just like lose myself in the world. I love that. Like, I'm not thinking like, oh, this is written, like where I get thrown out of the story and it's like, oh, I was just thrown out, you know? But like where you're reading it and it just like becomes the whole world around you. And it's just so beautiful.
I enjoyed my conversation with Lillian Chabert. She's a romance writer and she lives right here in North Dakota. Her latest novel, Freelance Fiancé at Mistletoe Inn, is a sweet small town holiday romance set right here in the state. You can find her work by searching Lillian Chabert online. And do you have a website that folks should be directed to?
Yeah, they can go to burningbranchpublishing.com.
Thanks so much for joining us today on Main Street, Lillian. It's been a pleasure.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me, Craig.
Romance is a slow dance to a sound as sweet as rain. It's a new song.
You are listening to Main Street on this Monday here on member-supported Prairie Public. I'm Eric Dethridge. We're listening to the sounds of UND alum Celeste Krenz taking us out of Craig's conversation. Well, during Celeste's time in Grand Forks, she may have had a night out or two at the very popular gourmet eatery in downtown, Sanders, 1907, with its larger-than-life proprietor, Kim Holmes. Big shoes to fill when Kim passed away, and Sanders evolved into Ellie's Ivy. And like Kim, its owners love supporting local musicians. It's got jazz on the regular and Grand Forks musician Tom Bruce. So we'll take you there in the next hour of Main Street. So stay with us. In place. The FM Symphony presents Masterworks 3, Symphonic Giants, January 17th and 18th. The program includes Dvorak's Slavonic Dances with the Area Youth Symphony and pianist Tyler Wattridge performing Saint-Saëns Piano Concerto No. 2. Information at fmsymphony.org.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. A new study calls attention to the health care needs of people who are unhoused or formerly incarcerated. As Mike Moen reports, a North Dakota lawmaker says the results resonate around the region.
Researchers aligned with the Minnesota Electronic Health Record Consortium looked at data covering more than 4 million people in that state. They found significant disparities when comparing various health conditions of people recently incarcerated or unhoused to the total statewide population. In North Dakota, State Representative Carla Rose Hansen says similar outcomes are observed by policymakers and providers who want to fix the problem.
The number of people who have a substance use disorder or a mental illness is an issue for our entire population, but it's especially emphasized in our criminal justice system.
In Minnesota, researchers say people who've recently been in prison also have higher rates of asthma, COPD, and other illnesses. In North Dakota, Hansen has been part of a working group that looked at improving reentry outcomes. She's hopeful about certain law changes, including ensuring people have Medicaid access after leaving prison. But she says more progress is also needed in housing and job support to create greater overall stability for this population. Wanda Bertram is with the Prison Policy Initiative, which provided a deep analysis of the Minnesota study. She says the findings put a finer point on what the research community was already aware of, adding that it isn't surprising to see PTSD also on the disparities list.
When you're in prison, there are a lot of different things that can be traumatizing. Witnessing violence is a major one. So is isolation for people who are in solitary confinement.
Bertram says the new information reinforces her group's recommendation to bolster public health assistance in all states for people trying to reenter society. But she says it comes at a tricky time with a Republican-led Congress passing changes to Medicaid that critics say will result in massive cuts, likely constraining state-level investments. This is Mike Moen for Prairie News Service.
And ICE and Border Patrol will see a $170 billion cash infusion starting in 2026 to dramatically step up immigration enforcement and deportations. That might be a problem for agriculture, as some 70% of farm workers are foreign-born and more than 40% are in the U.S. illegally. Zach Rutledge is an assistant professor who studies the ag labor market at Michigan State University and says U.S. farms can't afford to lose those employees.
There's been a crisis in farm labor for some time, and it certainly would be exacerbated by immigration enforcement. It certainly doesn't help.
Rutledge says the Trump administration is addressing the labor crunch by lowering the wages farmers are required to pay foreign guest workers. Farm workers' unions have sued to stop that change. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative. headquartered in Bismarck, a Touchstone Energy cooperative, generating and delivering electricity to over 3 million consumers in 9 states, spanning from the Canadian to Mexican border. And by Dr. Julie Peterman Bryant of the Bryant Clinic of Chiropractic and Acupuncture in Bismarck, naturally working with people to feel better, be healthy, and live well at all ages. Well, welcome back to Main Street. I'm Eric Dethridge in for Craig Blumenschein. Host of the Great American Folk Show, Tom Bruce So, is going to take you to one of his favorite hometown eateries later in the show, Ellie's Ivy in downtown Grand Forks, a place where music, food, and community all kind of come together. Every second Thursday of the month in downtown Fargo, folks convene for the live storytelling event, The Tell, where about 6 or so storytellers share something intimate and very personal about their lives, often funny, sometimes tender. The experience of a Tell show is thrilling and authentic. Well, here's a story from last month's Tell at the 4 and 4 upstairs from Side Street Grill and Pub. It's by Cheryl Bergeon. She tells a story of a supportive family in one titled The Evolution of Awesome Women.
So the evolution of awesome women. I am one of those people who did not choose to have children. Never looked at an infant or a child and thought, I want one of those. It's not part of my life. I have younger sister, younger brother, mom. They live in other cities. I've never been particularly close with my sister or brother. I do talk to my mom every day. That's family for me. And I was so fortunate that a number of years ago, 2009 to be exact, after a failed campaign for legislature, a friend of mine who had been on my campaign committees, actually that was a Public Service Commission campaign, I ran for legislature, lost. 2 years later, ran for Public Service Commission, lost. 2 years later, ran for Public Service Commission, lost. After that third campaign, a friend of mine, who is part of the audience today, said she really wanted to see the folks in the campaign committee who had met weekly and worked incredibly hard to make my campaign successful. She said, I'm going to miss seeing these people every week, primarily women. And we started then getting together once a month for a meal and conversation. 8 to 10 of us, come if you can, fine if you don't. And every month since 2009, we have gotten together first Wednesday, 5:45 p.m. at a restaurant in town. That friend coined the Awesome Women Group. Over the years, we've married, divorced, had illnesses, and I realized in the last 17 years that our conversations, which were wonderful conversations about life, about politics, started to evolve. And we started to compare ailments as the years went by. One had a kidney transplant. Another one had a broken shoulder. Another one had a broken hip. Hip replacement, shoulder healing, stroke. And as those conversations continued, and we continued to age, some married, some not, some with children, some without, I gained friends. In that time frame, I had a knee replacement. The awesome women from this group got me to rehab, got me home, got me to the Y to take a shower. In that time frame, after the knee replacement. And I've come to realize that these women, these awesome women, are my family here. At this time, One of them is dying from brain cancer. I go see her weekly. She knows who I am yet. She will not at some point. In this time, I watched my dad die of dementia. In this time, others have had adult children die, spouses die. And I realized the evolution of the awesome women gave me a family that I can rely on. I don't know what my future will bring in the coming years, but I know should I fall and break a hip, the awesome woman will be there. Should I become ill and need help again, the awesome woman will be there. I really appreciate that. We made it through COVID. We made it through all of these years. We add at times, others move on, leave North Dakota, go to warmer places to live, and we gain others. And for me, that's the evolution of awesome women into my family. Thank you.
Cheryl Bergeon on finding her family. From last month's The Tell in downtown Fargo, their next show at the 4 and 4 at Side Street is Thursday, January the 8th at 7 p.m. There will be music. There's a bar there as well. You can find more info at The Tell Facebook page. Coming up next, Grand Forks musician Tom Brousseau takes you to one of his favorite downtown Grand Forks restaurants. Support for Prairie Public is provided by Nodak Insurance Company, serving North Dakota for over 75 years, providing insurance products from auto, home, farm, and business. Details at nodakins.com.
I love going out to eat with my wife, Lizzie. She's in every kind of food, and she usually knows exactly where to go. And I love being the tag-along, though we don't get a chance really to go out much these days because we've got a lot going on at home. When we do get out, it's fun to share a plate, an entree, a salad, a glass of wine, although sometimes we have two of those. Recently, I read an old English text called Treatise of Love, and it details all the ways one should act and behave if one has found true love. And it reminded me of my wife, Elizabeth. I mean, everything that she does is perfect. She's elegant, patient. She's a great listener. These three qualities are always present, even when she eats. And so you can imagine me sitting across from her at the table at dinner. It's one of my favorite things to do to spend time with her. Lizzie is like a goddess. Not far from where I live is a neighborhood joint called Ellie's Ivy in Grand Forks, North Dakota. And I'm going to take you there right now in Dakota Diners. And incidentally, it was the last place that I went out to eat with my wife, Elizabeth. It's my sister's birthday party that night, Carrie Sapa. And apps were ordered to the table, and I usually don't really care for apps, but they were ordered. I sat down, and I decided to have one. And then I had two. And then I had three. They were so good. It's their signature award-winning salt and vinegar chicken wings. And damn, they were so good. I'm getting hungry just thinking about it. Each bite was an explosion, an extension of that rotisserie chicken melt. And I think you know what I'm talking about. The kind that you get from the grocery store that just like, bang, makes you so hungry. You have one bite and you want to have another bite. But these chicken wings had that puff of subtle tang, that vinegar and salt, and my God, what good stuff. They weren't your average everyday game wings, I can tell you that, but they should be at game day. And with the wings that night at Ellie's Ivy, I had a nice cold glass of bohemian style beer, and I'm just thinking to myself right now, you should try this. Let's go to Ellie's Ivy. visiting with Scott Franz. He's the owner of Ellie's Ivy, downtown Grand Forks, North Dakota, a staple restaurant here, not just in Grand Forks, but in North Dakota and also Minnesota. We're so close to the Minnesota border. Scott, how did you get into being a chef, being an entrepreneur, and taking over this restaurant here downtown?
I used to play in a band. We did some touring around when I was like 16 to probably 20, something like that. And when I was 17 years old, I realized that no matter where I ended up, if I learned how to like flip burgers or get in the industry a little bit, that I could get a job somewhere. You know what I mean? And it might not be the most grand things in the world, but at least I'd have some like experience. So, you know, even when I moved to Colorado for a couple of years, you know, I was cooking and ended up cooking more than playing music, and actually moved back into town. And I was going to move to Minneapolis to go play with some guys up there, but I was trying to get back on my feet and get some more money in, and ended up working at the Grand Forks Country Club. And the Grand Forks Country Club has this great chef, Andrea Baumgarten, and, you know, owned Burr Bombs and stuff in Fargo, just an amazing chef. And apparently she was hired as a consultant, so they needed to find a head chef, and I had enough experience at the time, so I ended up taking over that kitchen. And then we opened up Three Frogs after that, and then, long story short, I kind of like fell into doing the restaurant thing more than music, and life happened. You know, my wife now of 13 years, and we dated before that, but she's been in the industry since she was like 14 or 15 years old, you know, working 70, 80 hours a week for somebody else wasn't really happening when we were growing, you know, having kids and this and that. So we decided if we're going to work that hard, we're going to do our own thing. So this came on the market, and we took over the old Sanders building, and it's been good 8 years now so far. So we've got through COVID and just kind of went through it, I guess. You know, it's a journey, and it's something that you never know what tomorrow brings, you know, or what the future does. But right now it's going pretty well.
What's like a popular staple entree here at Ellie's Ivy?
You know, it sounds cliched, but like, I think our farm burger is great. People love it. It's probably the most local full entree that we have. I mean, we source the beef from Thief River. I got Tim Schimansky is our rancher that supplies us with all our ground beef. The bun we make in-house, and we're using, you know, Dakota flour and sugar and local eggs, even down to like American cheese. I think it's the best cheese that you can put on a burger, but my thing is I have a problem just buying American cheese because it's kind of funky. I did research and found out that the original Kraft, Mr. Kraft, I forget his name or whatever, was, you know, in 1913, was trying to figure out how to maximize his profits, and that's when he created American cheese by, you know, taking trimmings and stuff like that and basically ultra-pasteurizing them with a very high emulsifier, sodium citrate, which you can make with baking soda and lemon juice, but we can just buy it, and water, and you basically, I get this cheese from Wisconsin, a local person actually drives out there with a truck and supplies some of these other places, so I get a $600 block of cheese that's this 15-year-old cheddar that we're making American cheese for this burger. And it's so stupid, but it's like, it makes me so happy that we're like creating something that's like, it's a better product than American cheese, but it's still American cheese. In the summer, we got cucumbers where we make our own pickles for that, you know, local onions and lettuce that we get year-round. That burger in itself is like, it doesn't travel far, which is great. I mean, Wisconsin's as far as, you know, we get ingredients for it and probably the citrate. But other than that, everything else is like super local within, you know, 100 miles or so.
Is it difficult to stay local with ingredients? And what are some of the challenges there?
You know, we couldn't really open a farm-to-table restaurant like at the beginning of it because it takes a long time to develop relationships with different producers and ranchers. So it's taken us a few years to ramp that up, and then it always changes because companies go out of business or like they don't have things available or things, people just stop doing it sometimes too. So it's a lot of just finding people, sourcing it, plotting out in the future what can they supply us, what can we get. It's a lot of work, but it's fun, and I'd rather do that because I think we do it better than a lot of restaurants in the region. Obviously, it's a percentage, and I think our percentage is higher than other places do that. And when you spend money in a restaurant, it stays in the community because we're buying so much local, and it really directly affects people than buying from, like, Sysco and stuff like that. Of course, there's always that, you know what I mean? I can't get local fryer oil and those kind of staple products like that, but it makes it interesting, and I don't think there's anything as a 100% farm-to-table restaurant, but I think the percentages, depending on what we have in our menu, changes, and seasonally it changes, so it's interesting. You know, even we were talking about ground beef, Szymanski, he does all his stuff grass-fed, and he only uses a seventh of his land at a time, so he lets it grow back in the prairie and lets it graze, and it never hits any kind of grain. And with that, it becomes a seasonal product because you can't slaughter in the wintertime because they lose all their fat. So you can slaughter in the late spring and up until winter starts. But other than that, he's got to feed them so much more just to maintain. So it's interesting. You know, it's a lot different than just, I need 20 pounds of this and this and that, and, you know, hanging up the phone or putting it in on it. You know, everything's online now, but it's different.
We're visiting with Scott Franz at his wonderful restaurant downtown Grand Forks, North Dakota, called Ellie's Ivy. Scott, you mentioned Andrea Baumgartner, one of your, I suppose, contemporaries, maybe an idol in terms of chef and of food and of knowledge in that area. Who are some of your other idols that you looked up to?
You know, I actually got my start at the River Bend in East Grand Forks a long time ago, Bruno, the chef there, has kind of took me under his wing and showed me a lot of things. I learned a lot of things of what to do in a kitchen, what not to do in a kitchen. But it was pretty amazing. You know, when I moved out to Colorado, I worked at the Ptarmigan Country Club, and Mick Vanziski was the chef out there, and he really taught me a lot of different things. And, you know, Kim Holmes is somebody I really look up to, and never worked with him, but have always been in the community with him. And you know, talk to him, especially when he opened this place. It was, you know, I talked to him weekly, ask him for advice on, like, what do I do about this or what do I do about that? And he was always openly willing to help me out or give me any kind of ear. And it was great. So he kind of mentored me in an ownership way, I would say, more than, like, in a chef way. But, yeah, I mean, those are probably the big ones.
You mentioned Kim Holmes, who passed away, a few years back now, who had this place before you did. Sanders was the name of it. Scott, let's turn to some seasonal things that you might offer on the menu. Do you have one of those seasonal things that you can tell our listeners about?
Well, I mean, right now we're doing a lot more like comfort food items and stuff like that. Because beef prices have gone up so much, we've decided to like bring in some like wild boar. There's this company I work out of South Dakota that they can bring in a lot of stuff for me. And they're a small company, which, you know, if I'm gonna either bring stuff that's not in the region, I like to deal with smaller companies like that because it keeps them alive and it impacts their economy and not just putting money into like big people. But we're doing this shepherd's pie, which is great. We got some elk short ribs that we're doing. I mean, just really kind of home, you know, seasonal things there. We're starting to get into the time where I can start getting whitefish and lake trout from Bayfield, Wisconsin. It's another place that I try to draw from in the winter months. They do a burbot too. I don't know if you've ever had that, but it's an interesting fish. And one of my cooks is just in love with. It's an eel pout. So it's an interesting, it was kind of like poor man's lobster. It's great stuff. So we're going to try to bring in some of that. And that they only start fishing in January. And hopefully they get some of that. But it's interesting. You're trying to bring in, you know, quote unquote seafood, but lake fish, and trying to focus on that a lot more than bringing in stuff from, you know, the oceans, just because we are in the Midwest and it might not be in our backyard, but it's still, there's small companies, you know, trying to support.
Scott, who are the people who come into Ellie's Ivy?
I think it's a mix. You know what I mean? Like we get our regulars, but it's a really, there's not one demographic. We get some younger, you know, professionals. We get people that are a little older during lunchtime, and I don't know. It's kind of everybody, and we try to be a part of the community as much as possible. And it's a beautiful place, but we kind of try to be that neighborhood joint where we keep our prices as low as we can, even though we're buying local stuff. But we want that repeat business of people that can come in and not break the bank, you know. And sometimes it ends up being special events as well, too, which is great. But you know, we're just going to want to be a neighborhood restaurant.
What's the name all about, Scott?
So we originally purchased this building. We ended up selling it after a couple of years. But long story short is my wife and I actually got engaged in that booth right over there. And we were thinking about what we liked about this joint. And, you know, just brainstorming kind of names. And, you know, one of the things that we really liked was the ivy on the outside of the building. You know, it's always like, oh, it's such a beautiful building. And the other thing was the elephants in the bar. So there's these brass elephants that hold up the bar rail. And it's like, what about elephants and ivy? And Rachel's like, I don't know, how about Ellie's ivy? And they're like, okay, fine, that works, you know. So there's really not like a huge story other than that, you know. It's kind of silly, but a lot of things spur from that. And then it's spelled E-L-Y, and we kind of did that just to kind of, well, confuse the heck out of people. But it's more of a design thing, but it's also kind of like, if you're local, then you know it's Ellie's. If you're from somewhere else, it could be Eli's or Ely or whatever. But it's kind of fun.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being on the Great American Folk Show. As we've been talking here, this place has just been filling up. I think the party's just getting started here. But I want to thank you again for being on the Great American Folk Show, Scott.
Thank you very much, Tom.
Tom Brousseau in conversation with Scott Franz, owner of Ellie's Ivy in downtown Grand Forks, where they have live music, notably jazz, most Wednesdays. Hi, glad you're listening to Main Street. I'm Eric Deatherage. If you're listening during the 3 p.m. broadcast, All Things Considered is coming up in just a few minutes, including a look at some of the biggest stories in religion from 2025. If you're hearing us during the 7 p.m. Central broadcast, Hidden Brain with Shankar Vedantam always takes a look at the unconscious patterns driving our behavior through science and storytelling. Tonight, how experiencing awe can change us internally. Dakota Datebook is up next. The Bush Foundation, in partnership with Strengthen ND, announces the 2025 Bush Prize North Dakota honorees. The Bush Prize is an annual award that celebrates organizations that are highly valued within their communities and have a strong track record of successful community problem solving. The 2025 Bush Prize North Dakota honorees are TNT Kids Fitness and Hip Hop and Hope. More information about the honorees can be found online at strengthenND.com.
This is Dakota Datebook for December 29th. On this date in 1917, former Attorney General of North Dakota Henry J. Lindy died. He had suffered a stroke 3 months earlier after many years of illness. He was only 37 years old. Lindy had accomplished much in his short life, earning him front-page death announcements in the Bismarck Tribune, Grand Forks Herald, and the Fargo Forum. Lindy was born in Iowa in 1879 to Norwegian immigrants and earned a bachelor's degree from Luther College in 1901. After teaching for 2 years at Park Region Luther College in Fergus Falls, Minnesota, Lindy went on to the University of Minnesota Law School, where he was captain of the baseball team. Right after graduating in 1906, he moved to Plaza, North Dakota to practice law, bringing with him his new bride, Julia Martin. Plaza was founded earlier that same year after the Soo Line Railroad announced it was coming through the area. Lindy and fellow University of Minnesota law grad R.O. Miller arrived shortly afterwards to open their law office. That year, he also became first president of the newly established Plaza First Evangelical Lutheran Church. In 1908, Lindy won a seat in North Dakota's House of Representatives. In 1910, Mountrail County was officially formed. Consequently, Lindy moved from Plaza to Stanley, the new county seat. He began serving as the assistant state's attorney. He also ran successfully for a seat in the state Senate. Lindy's political rise reached its peak when he was elected as attorney general in 1914. One of his biggest achievements was writing briefs for the U.S. Supreme Court to uphold the Webb-Kenyon Act, which prohibited the transportation of alcohol into dry states. Unfortunately, Lindy lost his bid to remain the state attorney general in 1916 when future governor William Langer defeated him in the Republican primary. Lindy went back to practicing law for the firm of Lindy, Fisk, and Murphy in Bismarck. His ill health prompted him to move to Minneapolis. It was there he died, and he was laid to rest on December 31st. which would have been his 38th birthday. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Trista Razor Sturza. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
I think by most objective accounts, 2025 was a pretty tough year. So here we are, about to close the chapter on this one and open up 2026. Is there cause for optimism? Always. Well, here's a story that's yet to be told, but can you just imagine if this transpires? It can. Despite the elimination of federal funding and the shrinking and shuttering of public radio stations across the country, listeners have stepped up. The efforts to destroy public media have failed. Now, wouldn't that be quite the story for 2026? Well, it can be if more folks join people that have already said, hey, no way, you're not taking away my public media. Join them. Go to prairiepublic.org and make a donation of any amount. And thank you for powering Prairie Public.
This is Bird Note. Polar bears symbolize the icy landscapes of the far north like no other animal. The bear's way of life, its very survival, is inseparable from the Arctic pack ice. Less familiar is a remarkable bird that shares with the polar bear this vital link to ice, the ivory gull. Just as polar bears are clad in white fur, ivory gulls are feathered entirely in white, adapted to the whiteness of their world. Long-winged and graceful in flight, ivory gulls breed on the northernmost islands of the Canadian Arctic and other high Arctic sites. They spend the winter near the pack ice. The gulls feed on small fish and other marine life, but also scavenge carcasses, including those left by polar bears. As a polar bear consumes the choice parts of a seal, ivory gulls wait at the edge of the action, intent on sharing the leftovers. Global warming has brought increasing change to the world of ice-dependent species, such as the ivory gull and polar bear. This white gull, like the white bear, represents an entire ecosystem at risk, as the extent and the thickness of sea ice is decreasing. There's more on our website at birdnote.org. I'm Mary McCann.
And that's it for Main Street on this Monday. I'm Eric Dethridge. It's been a pleasure hanging out with you today. Tomorrow, Craig Blumenschein and Jack Russell Weinstein will dissect the difference between being happy and feeling content in another philosophical occurrence. In the meantime, have yourself a wonderful rest of your Monday.